Blog Talk Radio.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio today. This is Sunday, June 11th. This is our part two of our conversation with Tom Guerra on Gear Talk with John Talk Radio. Yesterday we talked about Howlin' Wolf and Tom's guitar, the 63 Strat that he owns, and we had a great conversation wrapped around that. We started off our conversation around Rory Gallagher's album, Photo Finish, and We had a little technical difficulties, but we made a lemonade out of lemons, and we've made that part one, and we're going into part two today. And we've got a lot of ground to cover as we talk about this amazing album and this amazing guitar player who may rest in peace, is no longer with us, as so many of the great musicians are. But Tom, let's start off today. And by the way, thank you for joining. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back, John.
It's great to have you on. I know you talked to some pretty important people. You talked to Todd McKenna and Jerry McAvoy and Rory's brother Donald, and got some insights on this album, Photo Finish. And those, and Ted and Jerry were on the album, and that's such a cool thing to be able to go back into history, as we talked a little bit yesterday, and to talk to these people that are actually a part of it and a part of history. And as you've probably noticed, Tom, when you talk to people with your career and things like that, that once you get to talk to these people that are in history and rock history, they're really down to earth and nice people, and they've got such an incredible story to tell. And I think it's, oh my gosh, it's like, you know, people have said to me how, you know, I've interviewed people that have done pretty well, and it's, you would never know, because they're just so connected, and they just love to talk about music and about, you know, what happened back then. And so let's start that out. Give us a little background on the album. I know we talked off mic a little bit. This was a kind of a he had made an album in I think it was in California, wasn't it? Didn't like it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's really this has been a labor of love for me talking to these folks, because you and I spoke a couple months ago and you said, I want you to come on and talk about, you know, an album that meant a lot to you and influenced you. So this was the first one that came to mind, Photo Finish. So I approached Donald, who is Rory's brother, Jerry McAvoy, and Ted McKenna, and all of them were just so willing to give me their time to set the record straight. And according to Donald, early on in Rory's career, he met San Francisco-based producer Elliot Mazur, who Elliot had done some great work with Neil Young. So Donald said the ambition of Rory was really, you know, let's tour in the U.S., and after we finish up a tour, let's end in San Francisco and start working with Elliot Mazur. And that's what they did in late 77. They started working on a record they tentatively titled Torch. When they were near the end of the album, the recording process, Rory ventured out on a cold January night, and his fate changed. He went to Winterland and to see the Sex Pistols of all people, who, you know, were finishing up a disastrous U.S. tour. But Rory was transformed that night by the experience. He just said that band really brought out the rawness to him. He loved the garage band vibe. He loved the energy of the Pistols. And right after that, even though he had just finished recording this album with Elliot Mazur, you know, this world-renowned producer, he started having second thoughts. So the record company was, you know, looking for product. The band then went to L.A. to meet with the record company, with Chrysalis Records. They hosted a party for Rory, sort of almost like a pre-launch party to celebrate the new release. It was at the Sunset Marquee. And it was here that Rory said to his brother Donald, who was manager, Donald, you know, you got to tell the label I want to scrap this album. So Donald was always left with the tough jobs. And then at that point, Rory decided to dismiss his longtime drummer and his pianist, Lou Diaz, Rod Diaz and Lou Martin. And he scrapped that album. And immediately after he made this decision, he actually caught his thumb in a taxi cab door, and he hurt himself, and he needed a little bit of a break, so he went home. So that was sort of the, you know, maybe akin to Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident, where he, you know, nobody knows how serious it was, but it did buy him some time. You know?
Yep. Well, that's so interesting. You know, when you talk, Tom, about the conversation that Donald had to have, and with the They had already laid the tracks down. Is that correct for this album?
Yes, they have. And this album subsequently came out in the 21st century posthumously as the San Francisco Sessions, I believe it was called.
Okay.
And it's good, but it's no photo finish. So I agree with Rory in his decision to, you know, he then, based on that, he picked up a new drummer. He put in a word out that, you know, he's looking for a new drummer. And he ended up with a great drummer in Ted McKenna. He used to be with the sensational Alex Harvey band. So Ted heard that Rory was looking for a drummer. He actually heard it from an engineer, Colin Fairley, and Colin was working with Rory. Colin said, hey, Ted, come on down. You want to fancy having a blow with these guys? And they went down to Air Studios, and this was in, I believe it was in May or June of 1978, and Ted ended up doing his first gig with Rory in June of 78 in Ireland at the Mountain Dew Festival. It's a massive, massive gig, and some of it's on YouTube, also known as the McCroom Festival. And that was, McCroom was on June 24th, 1978.
Wow. So what was the difference, Tom, in Ted's drumming? After Rory had heard the Sex Pistols and got this kind of epiphany on going back to the basic rawness of rock and roll, what do you think Ted brought to that?
Well, I think Rod was an excellent drummer, maybe more, definitely a lighter touch, was a little bit of a finesse drummer. Ted was just an ass-kicking rock and roll drummer. He could do really anything, but Ted was just really brought that energy. And if you listen to Photo Finish, it's got that energy on every track. So, you know, right after they did a little short tour of Ireland and Denmark and Norway, they ended up in Cologne, Germany. I believe this was July of 1978. Through an Irish engineer by the name of Alan O'Duffy, who had worked on Venus and Mars with McCartney, worked on a bunch of stuff, I believe Rory had heard about this studio in Germany owned by a guy by the name of Dieter Dierks. And he later went on to fame as being sort of the producer of the Scorpions. So he had sort of that hard rock background as well. So they loved working in Dieter Dierks' studio, and they only spent 2 weeks working in the studio, recorded most of the tracks live. And then, you know, Rory did some overdubs, but there's very little overdubbing on the album. It's just, there's a sense of immediacy on this thing that is just amazing. And, you know, Rory pretty much used his Strat for the whole recording. He did use a couple other instruments, some cool different amps as well, some Tweed Fender stuff, an AC30 Vox on a lot of it. That was really a big amp for Rory. And then right around this time, he started getting more into a harder sound, so he was using Marshall combos as well, according to Jerry McAvoy. So, and if you listen to a track like, I always thought Brute Force and Ignorance, which is a great track off of this album, was a Strat, but I found a video of Rory and the band rehearsing for the McCroom Festival, and he's playing a very strange-looking guitar. It's a Yamaha SX-800. At that point, it was about 8 years old. It was 1970. And I believe he plays that on the studio recording because it does have a slightly different tone on there if you listen to Brute Force and Ignorance.
Now, if we could take a little bit of time, we talked yesterday quite a bit about Howlin' Wolf's Strat. Talk about Rory's Strat, because he played the same one, didn't he, for a long time and was... I mean, just talk about that, Rory Gallagher's Strat.
Rory got that Strat early, early on in his career. It was the first one he had ever seen, and supposedly it was the first one to actually have been brought into Ireland. So this is way back in the day when Rory was just starting out his career. He was playing with Taste, his band Taste, which is sort of a power trio modeled after Cream. although some people say Cream was influenced by Taste. So there was a guy who had the Strat, Rory bought it secondhand, but he wanted a red one. He wanted something, you know, a little bit more flashy. So he sold the guitar, and it was a Sunburst 1961 Stratocaster, and Rory got the Sunburst, and he loved it. He just fell in love with that guitar, and it became, you know, when he bought it, it had, you know, it was, looked like a relatively new Stratocaster, even though it was probably 5 years, 6 years old at that point. The guitar was stolen at one point in time, and when it was stolen, it was a traumatic experience for Rory. He actually had borrowed another friend of his Telecaster because he had a big gig coming up in Dublin, and both the Telecaster and the Strat got ripped off after a gig.
Wow.
So he went into a major depression that week, and at the time in Ireland, I guess there was only one TV station at the time, so there's a show called Guardia Patrol, and this show featured Rory's stolen Strat. So, you know, there's one TV station, everybody's watching it. Within a couple of days, the cops found it. It had actually been abandoned in a drainage ditch.
Oh,
and
wow.
The rest is history. I mean, the guitar went back to Rory. Rory just played it and literally until the thing wore out. I mean, towards the end of the career, there was no finish left on the thing. And you know, that it's got Rory's battle scars on it. He claims that he had a very acidic type of sweat, and he sweated a lot on stage. So he claims that that sort of was like a paint stripper and taking a lot of the finish.
Yeah, that's,
I don't know.
That's wild. Now, where is the guitar today?
I believe the guitar, well, Rory's brother, Donald, owns the guitar now, and it comes out occasionally. I know Joe Bonamassa played it at the Royal Albert Hall a couple years back, and it's, you know, it is in Donald's possession, and it's, you know, a lot has been done to the guitar. The tuners were changed. The pickups were all rewired. Rory himself rewired the bottom tone switch to serve as sort of a master tone pot, rather. So you kind of get the wah-wah effects, which he did quite a bit. Roy Buchanan did that as well. And the pickguard had been changed, you know, and the guitar was really, in terms of a collectible instrument because of originality, it was not. But obviously it's one of the most iconic Stratocasters in the world. I mean, instantly recognizable. Wonderful sounding in Rory's hands, and it was really, you know, he really helped to put, I believe, the Stratocaster back on the map. You know, these things go in phases, and by the 70s, the Strat had kind of fallen out of favor because a lot of people were playing Les Pauls, you know.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting too, because I don't know what Donald's doing with it, but is he letting it like in a public view, or did you guys discuss that? Because I would think that would be something that would guitar lovers would just flock to see that.
Yeah, I really don't know. I probably should have asked them that, but because I certainly would love to see it, and I travel to see that guitar. You know, but it's really, I think it's got to be a sacred item for Donald, you know.
Oh my gosh! And it was, has Donald written a book? I don't know. That would be a pretty good thing if he has.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't believe Donald has, but Jerry McAvoy wrote a great book several years back called Riding Shotgun, and it's all about Jerry's time with Rory, and it was a great book. And of course, you know, getting back to our discussion yesterday and trying to absorb all the information we could about our favorite artists, you know, Rory never got a chance to write an autobiography, so this was probably as close as he came to that, having his you know, his right-hand man Donald, who was with him, right-hand man Jerry, who was with him for, you know, the bulk of his career, being his bass player, write the book from his perspective. That's why it's called Riding Shotgun.
Yeah, that's, I got to check that out. I will go on Amazon, Tom, right after this and push the magic Amazon button, and the book will be here in a couple of days, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
But I love that. So when you talk to Donald, what else did he say? Is there any insight? I know that that's really interesting about how, you know, he was not pleased with the way that, you know, the California sessions were going, the San Francisco sessions were going, and he wanted it to be a different direction. And I always think of that, like in behavior, it's like, okay, I'm not really thinking too much about the business side of it, but this isn't going to work, and we're going to go here, and we're going to do that. Did Donald give you any insight into Rory's character or how he was handling things? Because we talked, you and I talked a little bit about this, about how that people that are artists and that want to just make music, and they do whatever, everything else is secondary, but a lot of stuff comes with that, the fame, the fortune, all of that, and wanting your time and wanting you to do this. Do you have any insight, Tom, on how that affected Rory's character and how he how did he handle fame?
Yeah, well, I think Rory, out of any guitar player, virtuoso guitar player in the rock or blues genre, really, really had an inner voice that he listened to. And he could have, you know, Rory could have joined the Stones at one point. He could have had a hit record. He could, if he had just sort of bent a little bit and maybe sold out a little bit. But he didn't. He did exactly what he wanted to do, and he had a great, great inner sense of what was what Rory Gallagher was all about. So I think, you know, they're producing the album with Elliot Mazur, and I think he started to feel it started to get maybe too overproduced. And having seen the Pistols, he kind of wanted to, you know, really shake it up and make a raw, raw record, and that's what he ended up doing. He was very, very adamant about stating that it wasn't because of the musicians. You know, these musicians had stuck with him through thick and thin. It was a song thing, and he didn't think it worked on the technical side, the production side. So he said, "I scrapped the thing." You know, meanwhile, Chrysalis Records is pushing him for a new record. So that's where it got the title, Photo Finish, because they literally, you know, had like a couple weeks to finish this thing up. They got it in right on the deadline, based on those really successful German sessions at Dieter Dierks' studio. So, you know, Rory, according to Donald, you know, wanted to make sure he delivered that album, but they didn't have much time to do that. So, you know, that's sort of the story behind that, I guess. And you know, one of the tracks on the record, Rory had a big love for fiction, you know, crime fiction, detective stories, film noir, that type of thing. And there's a song called Last of the Independents, which is, it's actually a Walter Matthau film called that. But Rory sort of co-opted the title and, you know, wrote about sort of an independent gangster type of person. But you listen to that and you read between the lines, Rory truly was the last of the independents in terms of a guy that did what he wanted. He made his own calls. He pretty much, with the exception of his band, he worked alone. And I think that's what Last of the Independents is about. And it's got a wicked guitar break in the middle where Rory just kind of lights up the Stratocaster.
That's a perfect segue. Let's play that. Last of the Independents. Rory Gallagher. My guest is Tom Guerra, and you can go on Tom's website, tomguerra.com, G-U-E-R-R-A. His latest release is Trampling Out the Vintage. I highly recommend this. Let's play this, Tom. Then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about and try to, you know, get into some of the things, the sounds that we hear on this album. That when you were saying they did this in not a lot of takes, which I think is really amazing. So let's play. Yeah. This is Last of the Independents, and we'll be right back after this.
I
And we're back on John Talk Radio, our episode of Gear Talk. My special guest is Tom Guerra, and we're talking about Rory Gallagher's album Photo Finish, and we've got some great insights. When you hear that, Tom, I mean, that was in 1978, and a lot has happened technically since then. What do you think about the sound of right there compared to what can happen now? And then do you think the technology has advanced guitarists to make that better? Or is there something that's just original that no matter what, technology is not going to change that?
Yeah, I think technology now it's a great tool. And for editing, it's, you know, what used to take hours in slicing and splicing tape, now you can do in seconds with Pro Tools, that type of thing. But sometimes the music becomes almost about the technology today versus you listen to that track we just heard, Last of the Independents. I don't think anybody's thinking about splice and tape in that song. You know, they're thinking about, whoa, I've got to fasten my seatbelts because this thing is taking off, you know. And it was just an immediacy. It was a rawness and a realness, you know, that occurred on this album, and it's one of the reasons I really love it. In a couple minutes, we'll hear a song called Fuel to the Fire, and you listen to the solo in it, and just like the opening track we heard, Overnight Bag, and there's so much emotion he's putting into that. You can't fake that. That's a real thing, you know?
That's something I like to talk about just a minute, because when I talk to different musicians and people a lot about the different types of music, and one of the things, you know, like with roots music and bluegrass and different kinds of music that's real, and you know, no matter what, they can sit on a porch and play, it doesn't matter whether they're on a porch or whether they're in a coliseum, because the music is true and it's real. And you're talking about how emotional Rory's music was. Do you think that takes a toll on somebody when you put that much energy and so much of your life into your music that it's like exhausting to a musician to do that? Or do you think it's just kind of a natural thing?
That is a great question. You know, I think only Rory could probably tell us the truth, but I do think, I don't think that guy could have put any more into his music. So I do believe it took a toll on him. And I think he really suffered during the 80s because he was on fire throughout all the 70s. The 80s come with sort of the MTV rock thing where everything is, you know, skinny English ties and synthesizers. And he got left behind regarding what was mainstream. You know, not that he was ever mainstream, but he got really pushed back. I never forgot about him, and I think a lot, you know, millions of his fans never forgot about him. But I think because he believed this was his music, I mean, this was his life that he was putting into it. And I do think that, you know, it did take its toll on him. I don't know what more, you know, after Photo Finish, after Top Priority, the album that came later, you know, personally, I don't know how much more the guy could give because they were just opuses, you know. Opi, I guess, is the plural of that, right?
That sounds good to me. You know, it's such an interesting topic because, you know, you could look at where he might be today. You know, you just never know, because you talked about, you know, the Rolling Stones, and I immediately was thinking of Mick Taylor and thinking of, you know, he kind of where he, what he's doing today, and some of these guys that are kind of, I don't know, that you can't keep at a high level an entire, you know, 40 or 50 years. I mean, it can happen. There's a few people that can do it, but not that many. And
right.
You're going to ride the wave. You're going to get popular. You're going to, you know, have people swarming you at the airports. But then there's going to be the day where you're going to walk through and nobody's going to know who you are. And those are I think that kind of gets to these guys a little bit. But it's one of those things where once you taste that and once you get to that point, and then you have these people, Tom, that are still around that just can't replicate or duplicate that what they had back then. But
right.
What do you think of that? And I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think not every – you can't be, you know, totally cranking out amazing things all the time. I think it's like I talked to some musicians once, and they were talking about the renaissance of music from like 60 – in the 63 to 67, 68, there was this open window where all this amazing music just, and it shut for some reason. And like today, I was just talking to my daughter about, you know, some bands that she really likes. And I see, you know, some really good things in them, but you can almost track, Tom, a lot of the stuff back to that. Yeah, what would you think of where Mr. Gallagher would be today? What would he be doing in your mind if you could imagine, you know, what Rory Gallagher would be doing in 2017?
I think honestly, Rory, had he survived, he actually passed away after a liver transplant, and he had some complications from it, and back in '95. But I think if Rory was still alive, I think he would be still out there doing his authentic thing. I mean, there was no fooling with that guy. He was never going to be one who was going to be, you know, glam rocked out or, you know, attached to any fad. He'd still be pushing his great music. He'd still be writing. He probably would have, you know, he always sort of got into other styles of music. So he probably would have expanded that. I luckily for us, we have a wealth of the music he's left us with.
Right.
But I think he'd still be out there pushing it. I think maybe as a result, things would be a little bit different, because he'd be, you know, another one of those great players who are still around. I mean, I kind of think of Johnny Winter, who was a friend of mine, who we lost a couple years ago.
Right.
You know, Johnny did it up until the end as well. And, you know, getting back to your point of these guys do have a youthful intensity that burns really, really bright. Johnny, towards the end, you know, was still a great player, but he didn't have the fire that he had when he was 20. Who does, you know?
Really? A lot of people don't have it when they're 20.
That's true. And I think Rory probably, he might have mellowed a little bit as well, but I think they would still be playing what they considered to be true music to themselves. You know what I mean? They would, you know, just like Johnny right up until the end, he was playing and he was really had done a great job making a comeback.
Yeah, that's probably exactly. I agree with that. I think it would be just awesome. And sometimes it's very sad to think about, you know, where people, you know, what happened and what could have happened. But I guess you really can't do much of that. But when you did talk to Ted and to Jerry, did they give you?
Yeah.
I know we talked about Donald a little bit. Did they? What insights did they give you into Rory and into his kind of his, you know, his lifestyle and his character, and my gosh, man, it's just like that's the stuff that gets me. It's like, you know, this music is still living today and it's so emotional. And what was the guy like? What was he like to tour with? What was he like to, you know, did they give you any insights into that, or any insights into the album itself? You know, what it was like to actually record with Rory?
Yeah, actually they both gave me insights into the album. And I did get a little bit, you know, Rory was the boss, but he was a good guy too, you know. But in terms of the album, you know, they basically went there. Jerry was playing a Fender jazz bass he played for the whole album. Was playing it both direct and through an amp. And they mic'd the amp and they blended that. He got a really great bass sound. Back in those days, because of the intensity of the music, Jerry said the only way he played bass was with a heavy pick. Nowadays, you know, most bass players play with their fingers. But because of those downstrokes and that really driving music, Jerry was using a pick all the time with Rory. So basically they said, you know, they got together. They had only rehearsed the songs maybe three or four times, except for those that they played with Ted on those handful of dates they did before Dieter Dierks. But they ended up recording basically the first and second takes, maybe three takes, and seeing which ones really held together the best. And then if need be, you know, Rory would overdub a vocal, or he may change a little guitar line or something, but there wasn't a lot of it. I mean, you know, 2 weeks in the studio to record a whole album, you know, nowadays it takes that long just to get a snare drum sound, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's a good point, too, because there are some musicians that I've talked to that they're in a band and they have to tell this. There's people in there could be a certain person in the band that is never satisfied with this, what's laid down, and they always want to do it over.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, getting back to the realism of Rory's music, you listen to the solo he does in on the closing track of the album, Fuel to the Fire, and the first note he hits, it's like he kind of, you know, hits two strings and it sort of muffs the note out, but he hits it again and he nails it, and it just creates that much more emotion, because he could have gone back and fixed that, but it is real. And I mean, you know, it's just an amazing solo to it, you know, and you listen to that and you want to know about Rory Gallagher, you listen to that track and that solo, and it kind of says it all.
Well, let's play it. This is Fuel to the Fire. My guest is Tom Guerra. We're talking about Rory Gallagher's classic album, Photo Finish, and we'll be right back after this to finish up the interview with Tom. And if you have any questions, you can call in to 877-694-5613, and we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
As Fuel to the Fire, Rory Gallagher from his album Photo Finish. We're talking about that in depth today with my guest, Tom Guerra. And
yeah,
that is such an, I mean, that song just is like, wow. It, you know, I've listened to it several times, but it's got this kind of flow to it that is just incredible. And how do you think that, I mean, you've played in bands and played with different musicians, and how do you get people to play on the same page as that? Because A, it'd be something to do on stage when you're playing it live, but also to get in the studio and to get that same sound. I mean, have you figured that formula out, Tom?
Geez, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't shine Rory's shoes, but I think how he captured that was because they were playing it live, and I think that was a live track that they captured in the studio, and just really, you know, the band was looking to him, and they saw his intensity, and they really stepped up their game a lot, and I think that's how they captured that, you know.
Yeah. What are some of the things that when you look back at this album, and you know, we've got a couple of minutes, about 12 minutes left.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you would like to talk about this album, or maybe some of the things that we weren't able to touch on that you think are important for listeners and for let's just say musicians that are starting out or want to get want to really reach their potential? What would you say about this album? What are some of the things, Tom, that come out that this totally affected you and your playing when you were younger, and what is maybe something that a younger guitar player could get from this?
Well, I think first of all, you've got great songs. You know, you got 9 great songs. So again, everything always comes down to the song. From a guitar player's perspective, the tones he got were just, delicious, I would say, and very, different from song to song. Donald was telling me while he was in San Francisco, he discovered a unit that was built by Furman. It was a preamp, and it actually became part of his unit, his setup, and it was a preamp, and he used it at the beginning of Cloak and Dagger, which has some of the raunchiest tone and the beginning notes of that song, and he was using it apparently that Furman preamp through, I believe it sounds to me like he was using the Marshall at that point, through with the Strat, and it just is wicked tone.
Now, how do you when you set up to play right now? What is your gear setup?
Yeah, my gear today, well, in the studio, I use pretty much all different amps, and depending on what the song calls for, Marshalls or old Fenders I have, a couple Ampegs, and this Colby amp, which is a new amp. Mitch Colby is a genius in terms of his ability to capture great sounds in an amp. And Mitch used to head up Marshall North America, Korg. So he was the one who sort of brought back a lot of the Marshall reissue amps. And he started his own company called Colby. He also is now building Park amps. So that's my main live amp now. It's a great amp. And I'm pretty much playing different guitars in the studio. Live, I primarily play Strats too, because of the versatility that I learned you could get from a Strat through, records like Photo Finish.
And when you, what is the difference, Tom, when you're like laying something down in the studio and you're thinking, okay, I really want to make this work live. Do you have to alter anything you do in the studio to be able to make that sound like that live? Or do you think about that at all?
I think a little bit about that, but in the studio, I've always tried to make something very interesting sounding. So if you're in a trio like Mambo Sons is, or I should say was, we actually added another guitar player that's a great guitar player by the name of Russ Wachey. We would record stuff in the studio that would be as interesting as possible. We'd use different percussion and, keyboards. And then live, we would just go out and do it as a trio. And we would do pretty much different versions of the song. Now I think with the addition of the second guitar player, we're able to do a lot more. But I look at them as two different things. I mean, my objective when I go into the studio is not necessarily to make a great sounding live record. It's to make, whatever the song calls for. And if that may be an acoustic guitar, a 12-string guitar, something like that. So I will use as many tools as possible to do that, while still keeping it within the context of rock and roll,
Yeah. So what's going on? Do you have any projects or anything going on that you would like to talk about?
I'm doing some shows with the Mambo Sons once again, and I'm going to be playing over the summer with a friend of mine's band just as a guest musician. And I'm also doing some songwriting with my friend Kenny Aronson, the great legendary bassist, and he's out on the road now with the Yardbirds.
Right, yeah.
He and I have put some really interesting music together. I think some excellent music, and we're going to continue that partnership too. So I don't know whose record this is going to come out on, but some of the songs I think are some of the best things I've been involved in ever. So
that's awesome.
That's fun. Yeah, and I'm also doing some writing on my own as well. I'm pretty much always writing just because it kind of keeps me sane. Saner, maybe.
What, Tom, is the process when you, like a song starts going through you, whether it's lyrics or music, how do you capture that and how do you keep that fresh? Because I know that they can come and go pretty quick.
Yeah, I have a little digital handheld recorder that's like about the size, about half of the size of an iPhone, where I'll just be, thinking of ideas and I'll just sort of, hum them into the recorder if they're lyrical ideas or melodic ideas. And then I'll just go into the studio, my own studio, and, try to develop those. And that's basically how I write. I mean, I write music first. I write grooves first. I write lyrics, melodies first. It really depends on the song. It's all of the above.
Well, Tom, it's been great having you on. I really appreciate it. And this has just been a lot of fun. And I appreciate you coming on Gear Talk for the first show. And I've had a blast.
Thanks so much. Me too. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Donald Gallagher, who was great in helping me, and Jerry McAvoy and Ted McKenna, and also Dino McGarland, who's an Irish musician who helped get me in touch with Donald. So I wanted to thank all those folks, as well as you, John, for having me on board.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's just been great. And, hopefully they can listen and make them think about Rory and his genius and the things that we're able to just kind of go over. And we're going to – our last song today – well, I might play something later on. We'll play Cloak and Dagger. Would you like to just say a little bit about that, what that song means?
Yeah, this is the track that I was just talking about a couple of minutes ago where one of my favorite guitar sounds on this. Is Rory playing his Strat through the Furman preamp.
Oh, yeah.
Just getting this real raunchy, hideous distortion, hideous in a beautiful way. This is Cloak and Dagger.
That sounds like a good album name, Hideous in a Beautiful Way.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Tom. Take care. We'll keep in touch. And thanks, everyone, for supporting independent musicians and listening to Gear Talk today. We thank you, and everybody have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks.
Thank you.